Fine Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening, and boy, is it great gardening weather out there. It's going to be great gardening weather through January. Dan says, you know, as I promised, Dan, didn't I promise that, you know, go ahead and plant your stuff. Even if you plant it a little bit late, it's just going to seem to, it's just going to poke along. If you plant it in October, November, it's just going to poke along because the days are going to get shorter. And then I said, you know, but it's amazing. It really starts on Christmas Day. It starts about Christmas Day. You really begin to notice it. It's an amazing thing. And then every during the 12 days of Christmas, it's like every day it just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. You get this beat of these plants just getting bigger and bigger. It's amazing how they respond to the longer days. They know the days are longer. It takes them a couple of days, gives them 3 or 4 days after December 21st, December 22nd, in there, the solstice, takes them a few days to sort of get oriented, but boy, they just start responding to that increase in sunlight. Broccoli, my broccoli's just going berserk right now. It's just putting on head after head after head. It's really an amazing thing what happens. And it's just such a great time of year to be gardening. I hope you're doing it. We've been thinking, you know, we are so new to gardening here. We garden like we live in Boston. We garden like we live in Germany. It's terrible. We don't really understand how to garden in a place that is so open to gardening like Mobile. There's so many opportunities. So we grow the wrong things at the wrong time, and it seems really hard. And sometimes we just don't even know enough about how people have been gardening here. And I'm not talking about Grandma and Granddaddy, who had a great little garden out on Schillinger's Road in the days before Schillinger's Road was one parking lot after another. They had a great little garden out in that direction, and it was really beautiful. But I'm not talking about what I learned from them, and I learned a lot from them. I'm talking about what can we learn from people who have been gardening here for 15,000 years. How did they garden in this place? How did they keep the mastodons out of the garden? I keep asking myself this. It's an important question. You know, one of the interesting things is that their destruction of so much of the wildlife of Alabama 10,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, probably precipitated a crisis, created a crisis that they had to recover from. And one of the ways they recovered was to say, you know, we really better get serious about growing some of these plants around us. And about the time that they wiped out the elephants who were carrying around the ancestors of our wild squashes, eating those ancestors, spreading the seeds, by the way, animals usually spread seeds. About the time they wiped out the mastodons and mammoths, they found these wild squashes and said, you know, these seeds are actually really good. They're good for you. They began domesticating them very early on, 10,000 years ago. Interesting, isn't it? Wasn't corn. So I've been thinking a lot about that and how to take advantage of it, and it's something, you know, it's something we all need to think about a little bit more clearly, because we live in one of those times when things are changing. We are having an impact on wildlife and on nature broadly that is even more dramatic than the impact that our ancestors had 10,000 years ago. We're going to lose as much or more. And in that transition, a lot of the things we depend on for our own livelihood are going to be lost. And we're going to have to think about that. Just by the way, it's a good time of year to think about that. And this warm, sunny day in January can make you optimistic about the possibilities. We're going to talk a little bit about, before this hour's out, I'm going to describe to you what an old garden was like. I'm not talking about an old South garden from Gone with the Wind. I'm not talking about a Clark Gable, Vivian Leigh garden. I'm talking about real old South gardens, what they were really like, what that tells us about how people gardened 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago in this place, and how they lived very successfully on those gardens. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Meanwhile, I got a lot of questions coming up. David Hubble writes me, and this is a really difficult question. The termite people, David's mother has this beautiful orange tree growing close to her house. David's very proud of it, and it's a very beautiful thing. But the termite people decided she got a new termite bond, and they had to put out a termite poison around the house. And David's wondering, how is that going to affect his tree? Well, that's a good question. I can't tell you, because I got to know, there are many questions. First off, what kind of bait, what kind of chemical? Was it applied as a bait? Was it applied as a barrier? It makes a lot of difference, whether it's a bait or a barrier. It can make a ton of difference. Baits are usually put in little stations that are discrete little stations, and it can work really well. It's not meant to be an absolute chemical barrier, as they say, a curtain that exists along the house. If it's a curtain, it raises a whole different set of questions. And then the question is, well, what type of chemical did they use in the bait or the curtain? I can't tell you. We do know that the older chemicals were really bad. And probably, people blame cancers and other things on stuff that, Alabama Power or a chemical plant or other things nearby. But if you really want to know the causes of a lot of debilitating cancers and other things that people were exposed to during the 50s and 60s, you can look at the trematicides that people were using under people's houses. They were really bad. Really, really bad, and they were banned. They were incredibly persistent and incredibly dangerous. We don't use those trematicides anymore. We use different things. There's been a little bit of research about uptake of plants, how plants uptake most of these things. I think with most modern chemicals, as long as you're not eating plants directly out of the soil, like root crops, where trematicides have been put, I think your chances of being damaged by those chemicals are probably pretty small. Probably. That's no certainty. And I think eating the fruit of an orange tree is probably not going to be a big deal. As long as the way they apply the chemicals didn't harm the tree itself. It is a very good question. And David, if you can find a little bit more about what chemicals they used, I'd be interested in what chemicals they used and how they applied it. It'd be fun to talk about it. Carol in Bay Minette sent me a message saying that her neighbor wants to use leaves, but he doesn't have any oak trees. Is it okay to use the leaves from trees other than oak trees? You betcha. Any organic matter is fine. Any organic matter is fine. It's great, as long as it hasn't been treated with something bad. But every leaf is fine. It's not going to be a problem at all. Even black walnut leaves, we can talk about that if you'd like, are not a problem when they're mulched in a garden. They all decompose at different rates. They all have slightly different chemical signatures and different chemical breakdown components. It's interesting. Dogwood leaves, for example, and pecan leaves can break down very fast. Dogwood leaves are very good for your garden in terms of reducing releasing calcium, but they do break down very quickly, and they don't provide a lot of long-term organic matter. Oak leaves don't break down as strongly. They don't provide as much calcium, but they provide organic matter over a much longer period of time. So the more different kinds of leaves you use, the better off you are, actually. Don't feel bad if you want to use other. They're all going to be fine. They're all going to be great. Even magnolia leaves. I promised I'd talk about aphids, Bruce. You hold on. I'm going to get back to this aphid question. How to deal with aphids being tended by ants. We're going to talk a little bit more about old-time gardening.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night too.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. You know, I had a problem with aphids too, Bruce, and those of you who have problems with the little aphids, you know, they're little clusters of these little soft-bodied green or purple or orange insects that cluster at the very top. They're kind of fat-bodied little things, and there'll be dozens of them all really close together at the tops of plants, on the succulent growth at the tops of plants. In many cases, controlling the aphids is usually easy early in the season. Just spray the plants with water. Just blow them off. And it's amazing. I tell people with crepe myrtles, if you've got an aphid infestation on your crepe myrtles, you're going to get sooty mold, and that's going to be a problem later on. Watch for those aphid infestations coming out early on, and just spray them out of the tops, off the tips of your plants. It's the easiest way to deal with it. And you probably won't get the sooty mold as bad later on from all of the aphid poop. You won't get it at all. You'll get other problems, including the new crepe myrtle scale, which is getting to be a big problem. But usually you control aphids with water. And I suggested this to Bruce. And I used water pretty effectively. But here's where you run into problems. You've got some really persistent ants, and ants herd aphids, particularly later in the season. They begin to herd and milk aphids. I know that sounds crazy, but that's ants. They're smart guys, smarter than you are in some ways. They get the best of us a whole lot, and they milk those aphids. They milk them for the honeydew. We won't describe what honeydew is. But the honeydew is this little, you know, that sticky stuff that drops on you. I won't tell you where it comes from on the ant's body parts, on the aphid's body parts, but there it is, honeydew. So the ants milk them. They use that honeydew, and they feed it to their tribe back at the nest. And once the ants get involved, it can be very hard, because that means the ants are going to protect those aphids from predators like ladybugs and other things that normally just eat the aphids up pretty badly later in the year. So your ladybugs aren't effective, your wasp and other things aren't as effective, because the ants are protecting those aphids. In those cases, and that's what it came to, usually you can discourage the ants by daily spritzes with the hose, and usually it keeps the aphid population down, keeps the ants from getting too excited about it, and it controls it enough that it doesn't interfere with your harvest. You might not get rid of all of it, but it's good. If that doesn't work, Bruce, I would progressively move up. Use an insecticidal soap. It basically is a clean soap, not a dishwashing detergent, not a dishwashing liquid. I don't recommend that, because that can be too toxic. But something like Safer's, S-A-F-E-R, Safer's insecticidal soap, just a little spray, it can be very effective. It really does kill those aphids really well. It discourages the ants for lots of reasons. So I would go up, and it's pretty cheap. It's pretty easy. It will be effective for a little longer than a hose spray, and it's not expensive. It's easy, and it doesn't discourage predators, because we were talking about those predators and how important they are. And we talked about it in that conversation with you, having good predators like wasps and other things. The insecticidal soap doesn't discourage those predators from coming back, or the ladybugs from coming back and picking out the aphids that are left over. So Safers is really nice that way. If that doesn't work, then you can move up to something like neem oil, which is going to affect your predators a little more, your beneficial predators, but not like some things, but still, you can move up to neem oil later. But I would move from the water to the Safers insecticidal soap, and then up to the neem oil. And this is generally not going to be a problem. The ants don't tend to start tending aphids until much later in the season, I find. You don't usually have that problem early in the year. It's just a problem later in the year. And Bruce, by the way, there are lots of aphids that are herded by ants. All of the aphids seem to be really vulnerable. All of the common aphids seem to be vulnerable to being herded by ants. And lots of different kinds of ants can actually herd aphids. Fire ants do it really well, but, you know, I think Argentine ants and lots of other types of ants do it as well. So there's that story. Something that could be useful for you as you're planning your garden for the coming year, what to do about those aphids. Bruce, I hope that helped. If it doesn't, and Bruce, you call me back and you just let me have it. if those methods don't work, let's talk about it. I want to make sure that your experience with aphids is not as bad as it was last year. And remember, a little bit of insect damage, not a problem. You'll get a few aphids, a little ants, that's okay. I had plenty of aphids and ants on my okra last year. I got rid of, I kept the problem from getting much worse. I still had problems with aphids and ants, but you know what? Didn't seem to affect the harvest of the okra at all. And that's an important thing to remember, is that a little bit of damage from insects usually doesn't hurt at all. It's only when it gets really bad that you need to start worrying. That's usually about 30% damage is how some people look at it, about 30% damage to leaves. But we can talk about that more. Hey, I said we were going to talk a little bit about what an ancient garden, what an old South garden really looked like on the Gulf Coast. And I found remnants of them. It's interesting. They're not, the biggest gardens, probably the most widespread gardens, the gardens that were gigantic in the earliest cultures and that had the most impact on the landscape. So you could look at it and say, phew, was the Mississippian gardens. This was before the Europeans came. The Mississippian culture, and let me tell you about that Mississippian culture. It may have started on the Mississippi. Actually, it may have started even farther south in Mexico. There was a lot of trade between the Mississippi, early Mississippi cultures in Mexico, and between places like Cahokia and places farther south. But that culture spread into Alabama. And so by 1200 AD, this is an interesting fact, Alabama probably had the two largest cities in North America in 1200 AD. One was at Bottle Creek, and the other was down right in the middle of the Mobile Tensaw Delta at a place called... That is Bottle Creek. The other was up at Malville. So Bottle Creek in the middle of the Mobile Tensaw Delta, and then Malville, two largest cities, Malville up near Tuscaloosa, two largest cities probably in North America about 1250 AD, certainly north of Mexico. And it's just, they were very important. And they were based on corn culture. Corn was hugely important to those cultures. It was a relative newcomer to the scene, and they were really exploiting it. And they had really become highly dependent on corn. They were planting it in the bottoms of the Delta where they could. They had wiped out timber over large parts of the Delta, very interestingly, and probably the destruction of the timber, which they used for fires and other things, and the heavy dependence on a single crop may have doomed those cultures. Politically, they were doomed for a lot of reasons too, because their influence had become so wide spread. I mean, those cities would have been very important. People would have been very afraid of the leaders of those cities. They would have thought, gosh, you know, these cities are so big, they can't ever fail. And they did fail. And they failed in a pretty spectacular way, and they did it pretty quickly. But it's not those gardens that I have seen the remnants of. It's a different kind of gardening that was older and more persistent than the great corn gardens of the Mississippi culture. Let me talk about it. We're going to talk about it when we come back from the break. They're very interesting. They're very interesting, and they're scattered all around, and it's fun to think about them.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round all the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that is where all become tiptoe.
It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Beautiful Sunday morning, talking about lots of different kinds of things. Let me tell you, I'm thinking about Old South Gardens. And by Old South Gardens, we mean the kind of gardens that people had to protect from mastodons and mammoths. It's not impossible, but it's a threat. You know, I think people in Africa have gardens, and they often have to think about, what do we do about the elephants? And sometimes the elephants go on a rampage and can destroy a garden. But most of the time, people are pretty successful and keep the elephants stay in their place and the gardens stay in their place. And I don't know, they probably figured it out. But gardening is an old, old tradition, as I've been saying over and over and over again. We think of it as, we only know about the new kind of gardening, the kind of gardening that you do with a tiller or with a plow. But gardening has been going on very successfully for a much longer period without plows and without tillers. And it was far more diverse in a way than the kinds of gardening we do now, with a lot more types of plants that were being used. And one thing I think that really distinguishes those gardens is that there wasn't a clear distinction between the garden and everything else. And there wasn't a clear plants, you didn't have a corn garden and then a tomato garden and a place for your eggplants here, and it was mixed together in lots of very interesting and beneficial ways. One of the places where I think we can see remnants of those old gardens, the old, really old South gardens, gardens that are probably remnants of gardens that were thousands of years old, If you want to see the structure of those gardens, the shell mounds, some people call them middens, trash heaps, but they're not trash heaps. They're pieces of architecture and agriculture all at once. It's like your house and garden got all mixed together. It's how these old shell mounds were. It's very interesting places. And they were the sites of communities that were created by people thousands of years ago, before there were Creeks, before there were Cherokees, before there were Choctaws, before those names even came along, probably even before, maybe even before the Muscogee language became imported here by people much, much older. Before the Mobilians, even before the Mobilians, from which Mobile got its name, before the Alabama, from whom Alabama got its name, these people were creating gardens on these shell mounds. We know that those shell mounds were created at least 5,000 years ago, probably much older. And it was created by people eating a certain type of clam or by eating oysters that they found along the banks or in the waters of the Mobile-Tensaw Delta or Mobile Bay or the old Alabama River, when the Alabama River ran through Mobile Bay, and Mobile Bay was a big valley, a big forested valley, and the Alabama River ran through it, and they were still collecting rangia there and eating them and putting them there and building these little features. And it quickly became a form of architecture that they created and deliberately managed. And it's also obvious that they deliberately managed plants there. And those plants are still there. They're very interesting. And so plants that there's a very interesting plant that I think about all the time. We don't really have a good name for it because it's so uncommon. It has no common name that really works. Sagaridia minutiflora. I'm going to have to come up with a name for it. I'm going to call it, let's call it the vining huckleberry. That's a good name. It's not really a blueberry relative. It's not really a huckleberry blueberry relative. But it has fruit very similar to that. Very tasty fruit. And that fruit is some of the first fruit produced in the year. It's produced in, you can start picking it in March and April, long before the blueberries have started ripening their fruit. Maybe even some years as early as February. It flowers in November, and very early in the year, very late in the year, it flowers, and those fruits develop over winter. Sagaridia, it grows as a vine, and the only place I have ever seen it, I have never seen it any other place, and in fact, almost no one else has ever seen it any other place, is on shell mounds created by humans. Now, this is very interesting, isn't it? It's really weird. What we don't know is, was Sagaridia moved around? Was this vining huckleberry, as I'm going to call it now, was it moved around from place to place by the Indians and just deposited in their gardens? Or did it grow occasionally on shell hash, even around Mobile Bay, and the only place it persists? But clearly, it's part of a human effort to preserve that plant on these shell mounds and to grow it there. And it grows really well there, and it still persists there today. It's fascinating. It is fascinating. It's incredible contact with the first people to garden, with the first gardens. When you see that Sagaridia, when you see that vining huckleberry, and you eat those fruits, you're eating the fruits of the first agriculture along the Gulf Coast. Really fascinating. Really interesting. And there are lots of other plants that you see on those shell mounds that you see no place else, almost no place else. Yuccas. Yuccas were probably really big, and you'll see yuccas in other places, but almost always you see some yuccas associated with these shell hash or these shell mounds. That's probably where it grew originally, and it is and some of the big yuccas, we know that the Indians used it for the roots, being edible. The flowers, the fruits were probably used, and certainly the leaves, in lots of interesting ways. When you see plants on those shell mounds, you think, I bet, I can just about guarantee you that had a human use that was very important, particularly if it's an unusual plant that's not occurring in other places. There are lots of other plants like that. One of them is the old North, what I'm going to call North American quinoa, simply because that's where you are right now. You hear about quinoa, you read about it all the time. It's an ancient South American crop that predated corn, very important grain, very nutritious. North Americans had their own version of quinoa. It was closely related, not the same plant. It grew well in North American conditions. It's a beet relative, actually, as is quinoa. And it was very nutritious, incredibly nutritious grains. And we've probably lost, they selected those plants to produce bigger and bigger grains. But the descendants of those plants, which no longer have the really gigantic grains that the original ones did, I think you still see traces of them on these shell mounds. And we call them lamb's quarters, goose foot, lots of other names. Those I collect those plants, and I keep looking for the big seeded ones. They're very interesting, and the leaves of those plants, you know, you don't eat the corn leaves. People don't eat corn leaves. They use them for other things. They use them to wrap things in. They're really great that way, or corn husk and other things. But the leaves of this old ancient plant were actually quite delicious and are one of my favorite greens and something everybody should try. They're really delicious, really fabulous greens. You often see them associated with these old shell mounds too. So these old shell mounds are beautiful remnants of these old gardens. I could talk about them for a long time. I talk about the buckeyes, which you don't want to eat, but which was probably an important crop in helping you to capture fish. And we can talk about why and why that was so important to those early cultures. And you often see those buckeyes growing on those shell mounds. Even though the nearest buckeye may be forever away, you'll usually see buckeyes growing on those shell mounds. Very happily there, along with a lot of other plants that probably had human uses. Remnants of these early human cultures. And there's other remnants too, and we'll talk about them. We'll talk about them if we get a chance. But I know I've got a caller. Is it Tommy? Who's my caller there?
Tommy Lee.
Hey, Tommy, how are you?
Good. How are you doing, man? I'm really enjoying your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I called in a few weeks ago about the sea oats and on the Fairhill Beach.
Right.
About the sea oats on the Fairhill Beach?
Right, sure.
I went down there and I checked on them, and the plants are thriving.
Great.
They got cut down by the city, but there was the old, you know, they're coming back. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I'm hearing you just fine. Well, good.
I just wanted to give you an update. You know, no need to worry. It looks like there's going to be a good crop of sea oats in this next season.
Yeah, and as long as they didn't tear those roots out of the ground, I'm sure they'll come back really well. Well, that's really great to hear.
Well, I just let you know.
All right, great, great. You know, they have to live the storm surge.
Eyes on the ground.
All right. Tommy, thank you. Thank you for letting us know. All right. Hey, I know we stretched that break a little bit. We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to be back. We don't have a lot of time left, but give us a call if you get a chance.
And the years since I saw you, there's a trunk in the corner I keep on my lips.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. We got a couple of little questions we need to run through. In Irvington is asking me, it's now a good time to put out cottonseed meal. The great thing about cottonseed meal, John, is you can put it out anytime. It's not going to have a, it's only going to have a small effect right now because it tends to break down more readily when the ground warms. But there's no problem with putting it out right now. And in fact, this is a great time to put it out. Probably as good a time as any. Maybe you could argue the best time, because that means that it'll be sitting there ready to break down, ready to become active as soon as the weather warms when plants need it. Sometimes if you need an early spring boost for things like citrus and other things, it's particularly useful to put it out now. And sometimes you want a little bit more active nitrogen early in the year for those citrus, but I think you're going to be just fine. I just confused the answer more than I should have. Put it out now. There it is. It's a great time to put it out. It'll be fine, and it'll last all year. It breaks down slowly, and that's the great part. And so it becomes available. The warmer it is, the more moist it is, the more it becomes available, and the more it's used by your plants. So it will continue to break down into the summer. It breaks down slowly in spring, which is good. But put it out now. Put it out now. Greg, it's good to hear from you again. That is a strange contraption, isn't it? With those tractor wheels. Greg sent me a picture of a strange vehicle out in the middle of the woods. It was something I've obviously used at the old dairy. I can sort of see it with that wide frame being used to... I don't know what it was used for, but I think probably to span the rows so that it could go, so that the wheels straddled the rows so that it didn't run over it that way. Is my best guess. It's an interesting contraption, though, isn't it? Really interesting contraption. Janet sent me a question saying. Ask me a question. She had, and several people may have this problem this year. One of the limbs was broken on her Satsuma, and it was broken near the trunk. Not the best place in the world to have a broken limb, because you leave that scar on the trunk. There are two things you want to do, Janet. You do want to go ahead and cut the limb off, because it'll continue to rip and tear at the trunk, and that could be a problem. I think the thing to do at this point is to go ahead and undercut it. If you've got a real fine tooth pruning saw, not a coarse tooth pruning saw, but a pruning saw with real fine teeth that makes a real good cut, a real clean cut, go ahead and cut that limb off about halfway. Just cut it off in the middle of the limb. Just cut it off so that there's no more weight dragging it down. Okay? That makes the rest of the operation easier. And then go back right where that limb broke off, and it broke off right at the trunk, folks. This is a bad place. But undercut it just a little bit with that fine-tooth saw. You don't want to dig any deeper into the trunk than it is. But just undercut it kind of close to the trunk. Okay, undercut it with that saw. And then finish it off by cutting down from the top with a nice clean cut. There are a couple of things you want to do. You don't want to dig in deeper. You don't want to take out any more live wood. You want this wood to be able to repair itself. You want as much live wood as you can to make the repair. But you also don't want it to trap water. So when you cut it, you want to cut it so that everything's on a slant, so that the water drains off. You see what I'm saying at the bottom? So be thinking about that. When you make that cut, just make it with a slight slant so it drains off really well. And yeah, I do think you want to cut it off, Janet. I think it'll be pretty important to do that. Dan says, you know, Dan's always challenging me to say more and more. Dan planted his sugar snaps today, and that's a great thing. But Dan says, okay, tell me about all these biological mechanisms of plants, photosynthesis, respiration, germination, and I'll do it in the 2 minutes I have left remaining. No, I won't. We'll talk a little bit more about it next week. We'll try to talk about fertilizers next week. It's a good time to talk about it, a good time to think about it. You know, first off, the most important, the thing I stress over and over and over again, plants are green for a good reason. They did something really wild. They changed, photosynthesis changed the earth. The earth would have been a very different place without it. The dawn of photosynthesis, the dawn of chlorophyll, and the ability to use sunlight to produce energy created the first great pollution event in the world and wiped out tons of life. It was kind of amazing. So life was kind of evolving along one sort of way, and then this thing called chlorophyll and photosynthesis came along, and it changed everything. And it's the thing we still can't figure out because we don't do photosynthesis. We depend on photosynthesis by eating plants that do it, but we don't do photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is the manufacture of food within the plant. We don't manufacture food. We consume it. We don't manufacture it. Plants manufacture it through photosynthesis. They need a little bit of certain minerals to make that work. It's almost like those minerals aren't really the food. They're like the lube. They're like the grease that sort of keeps everything else going. And that's how I describe these minerals. There are lots of them, and they provide little pieces of the puzzle in photosynthesis. Next week, we'll try to talk about those fertilizers and what they mean to your plant when we come back. And maybe we'll talk about those old gardens again, too. Hey, it's been good talking to you guys. We'll be back next week. Please enjoy the January weather and the great gardening.